Chapter 15. Lucky Diamonds. Saul Plotnick was another new client looking for assistance in China. He was in diamonds, and his company was one of the select few that purchased rough stones directly from De Beers, the world's largest diamond cartel. It was a family business, he explained, one that had revenues in excess of $1 billion. "So, what do you know about the diamond industry?" he asked me. The truth was, not much. I mentioned that I had recently read an article about an Uzbek billionaire who was giving De Beers a run for its money. He was glad that I mentioned the man. "Who? Lev Lviv? We put him in business." We sat in his hotel room in Shenzhen, and over a coffee table, he opened a portfolio of laminated pages, advertisements that showed where his company's diamonds were sold. Escada, one of Europe's leading fashion houses, was a client, and so was one of America's largest discount wholesale clubs, those membership chains where a customer could purchase frozen shrimp in bulk along with automobile tires. He was one of two brothers who ran the company that had been started by their father. The family name was that of the company as well. Our meeting turned into a history lesson, with Saul explaining how his family had gotten into the diamond business. As a young man, his late father had been sent from South Africa with an assortment of stones for markets in Europe and asked to discover what prices they might fetch there. Saul spoke of the senior Plotnick not so much in the manner of a son recalling a deceased father, but in the way that one talks about a legendary public figure. He told me that his father would have done just as well in any industry. It just so happened that he found himself in diamonds. His father's innate sense of pricing was what had been their key to success. The reverence with which he spoke of the family patriarch made me think that he might actually be a legend in the diamond industry. We traveled by van and met other family members who were directly involved in the business. We were joined by Saul's wife, his brother, and his nephew. They were from Belgium, but spoke multiple languages and rotated among them quickly as if playing a game. The family was Jewish, devoutly observant. The men dressed in dark suits and wore kippahs. Bouncing down the highway on our way to visit a diamond polishing factory near the town of Zhongshan, it was as though we were in an old-world caravan, the sort that my own ancestors had probably taken on their way to settling in Romania and Poland hundreds of years ago. I listened as their conversation switched from French to English to Yiddish to what I figured to be Flemish. So many languages, and not one of them the tongue of the land in which they were hoping to make their way. On the return trip from a second diamond factory, Saul told me about his plan. He was going to sell diamonds in China. He sounded confident, as if the only question had really been his family's will to enter the market. There were some obstacles, one being that the Chinese government would only allow local manufacturers to make direct sales, but that was the point of visiting these diamond polishing facilities. His company would set up partnerships that would give them a backdoor entrance into the market. For a moment, I thought Saul might ask me what I thought about his plan to sell diamonds in China, and I was relieved when he didn't. The bigger issue, I thought, would be finding the demand. Chinese women did not consider a diamond ring any necessary part of a marriage proposal, and while gems held a special place in Eastern cultures, diamonds were not exactly as significant as gold, jade, or silver. The idea of a diamond offered at engagement was an invented tradition anyway, and in its marketing materials for the United States, De Beers proposed that men budget 2 months' salary for an engagement ring. This proposed metric was particularly meaningless in an economy where average workers were earning just a little more than $100 each month. Another obstacle was that Chinese were not in the habit of making payments for jewelry. The plan, as Saul saw it, was to replicate what had worked for the company in other parts of the world. In the United States, they had done well by moving large volumes of diamonds through the warehouse clubs. Through these channels, Plotnick had specialized in selling imperfect diamonds to middle-class Americans who didn't care about occlusions or other imperfections as much as they did the size of the diamond or saving money. China was a market full of opportunity, but it was a difficult sort of place. I suggested that China was different, but my comment was not one that Saul wanted to hear. He was set on developing business opportunities in China, in part because his company had no choice. De Beers was a cartel that had once controlled price almost exclusively by holding back supply from the marketplace. A global management consulting firm had done work for De Beers and concluded that it needed to work the other side of the equation by increasing demand as well. The cartel took the consultant's advice and then used the primary means for moving diamonds that it had, sight holders, to take on the task. This was really how the Plotnik group had come to be in China without any idea of how it would address some of the rather large market issues. Though not a marketing company, Plotnik had to show the De Beers group that it was doing whatever it could to boost global demand. I knew others who worked in the diamond industry. It also suffered from the kind of quality manipulation that was prevalent in manufacturing. Chinese diamond cutters were, I understood, in the habit of cutting diamonds in an asymmetrical fashion so as to get a slightly larger gem out of the rough diamond. After this was done, a jeweler could then get a fake certificate authenticating the diamond as being of a higher quality. My standard position on all new ventures in China was that they had to be looked at with a healthy dose of cynicism. In passing, I mentioned to Saul that I personally would not jump into any China business without learning more about how the game was played. "Psht," Saul said when he heard this. He dismissed any comment advising caution as irrelevant. "Other sight holders are already in China," the nephew pointed out. "Do you know Dalumi?" "That's the name of your competitor?" I asked. "Dalumi?" I smiled without meaning to, and the nephew wanted to know why. "Dalu" was how people referred to mainland China, I told him. And the character for uncooked rice just happened to be me. Uncooked rice granules were not exactly the image you wanted to put into a consumer's head when trying to sell rare gems, and if I spotted the joke, then the Chinese marketplace surely would pick up on it. Saul's nephew was pleased that I had found something laughable about their competitor, and he was fascinated by the idea of translated names. "What does our name mean in Chinese?" he asked. By itself, it meant nothing, I told him. And then I tried to explain that it was just a coincidence that his competitor's name sounded silly. "Plotnik has to mean something. It probably means something really good," he insisted. "I bet it's lucky." He had an excitable look in his eyes, and I thought of D.H. Lawrence's rocking horse winner and the little boy who rode wildly on his hobby horse. But Western names did not always mean something in Chinese. To translate a family name, I was going to have to think first about matching up all the syllable sounds. There was no plot symbol in Mandarin. It would have to be Pu La Te or Pa Lu Tuo, three separate characters each. I was getting a headache just thinking about the number of permutations. I told him that I would need time to put together some options. He insisted, though, that I deliver the translation immediately, expecting that the result would be a pleasant one. Foreigners of all kinds were attracted to the allure of what seemed to be a magical culture. To see this ultra-Orthodox Jewish man getting caught up in the country's fortune-cookie mystique was too much for me, though, and this kind of fetishism reminded me of the pizza shop worker in Philadelphia, the one who had an error tattooed the Chinese character, education, on his neck. Jews and Chinese had much in common, including an interest in education that went back thousands of years. There was one tradition whose seminal text began with a verse, "To study, and at times to go over what one has studied, is this not the greatest pleasure?" It sounded as if it was something right out of the Talmud, the ancient Jewish text, but it was actually from the Analects of Confucius. And out of this tradition for study came a reverence for the written word that extended to the superstitious. In World War II, when China provided sanctuary to an estimated 30,000 Jewish refugees, those who were told of the possibility that they might go to Shanghai needed no encouragement after hearing the city's name. The Hai in Shanghai sounded like the Hebrew word Chai, which means life. This one word had powerful connotations. It was the two-letter symbol that some Jews wore on necklaces, and it also appeared in L'chaim, the toast offered when glasses were raised, to life. Chinese were just as superstitious when it came to naming, and it was said that those Chinese who immigrated to Canada and settled in the British Columbia city of Richmond did so because to them the city's name sounded like rich man. After a visit to Shanghai's Diamond Bourse, where Saul tried to secure the largest office space inside the exchange, we went to visit jewelry stores in the city's commercial district. Saul went straight to a showcase in one store and pointed to three diamond rings. He asked to inspect them. Looking at the diamonds through his jeweler's loop, he made a face. There was something that he did not like about them. It was not that the diamonds were bad, quite the opposite. He said that they were too nice. Each diamond was clear in color and free of any flaws. He muttered and said that it was not what he had expected. China's luxury market was a paradox. Though living in a developing country, mainland Chinese either purchased at the top of the market or else they chose not to buy at all. Chinese preferred to postpone major purchases until they had accumulated a more substantial amount of wealth, and their pattern of saving was at least partially influenced by great instances of poverty in Chinese history. Researchers have recorded over 1,800 major famines in China going back to the 1st century BC. Starvation has a way of changing behaviors, and one of the most certain ways that an individual could lose scarce resources was to advertise that he had them. During a famine, someone who thought a relative was hiding a small cache of grain might literally kick down the front door and search the home. In mainland China, even though things had improved greatly since the Cultural Revolution, the tendency was still to hide accumulated wealth, at least until some tipping point had been reached and it mattered less who learned the extent of such wealth. They spent only after considerable wealth had been accumulated for another reason having to do with face. Chinese postponed major purchases so that they could do things in a more enviable manner. To buy luxury goods that involved compromise or economization sent the wrong message. Walking through the street on the way back to the van, our small group was approached by three elderly women. One woman held out a number of watches for me to inspect. "What is it? What do they want?" Saul asked. "Rolex watches," I said. He was interested in the watches, to my surprise. His company was one of the very largest diamond wholesalers in the world. If there was anyone who needed a counterfeit watch less, it was Saul. This was nothing unusual, though. Foreigners on business were invariably interested in counterfeit products. They liked them for their novelty, because they were sometimes hard to come by, and because purchasing them involved the sport of haggling over price. "Ask them how much they want," he said. The woman nearest to me named her price, and there was a brief moment of back and forth until she settled at 100 renminbi. It was about $12 at the going exchange rate. It was a low price, even for a fake. Saul kept walking and thought about it. "Tell her that I will take three, for 50 renminbi each." The women looked not just old, but frail. They labored just to keep up with us as we walked at a pace set by Saul. The price they offered was already extremely cheap, and I told him so. He shot me a look and said, "If they can't do 50, tell them to forget it." I held my tongue, but was quite certain that they would not agree. Hearing the counteroffer, the women pulled long faces, and then they fell behind as we walked on. In an effort to save myself from embarrassment, I offered to take three watches for myself. Maybe they could make up for the low price through volume. As we climbed into the van, Saul looked at me with a raised eyebrow as if to say, "What's it going to be?" The women saw this and exchanged quick glances. I got into the van myself and was just about to close the door when the old women said they would like to make the trade. Watches and money quickly exchanged hands, the van door closed, and we were again on our way. Saul looked at his watches and crowed. "You see," he said, "I told you that I was going to get 50, and I got the 50. It was the first time that I had seen fake watches sold so cheaply, and by the time our plane landed in Hong Kong, I had an idea why they were sold at such a low price. The minute hand on one watch fell off, and then I realized that all three of mine were broken. I said nothing about my watches, but suspected that everyone else got the same deal. Our last stop during our trip together was to be an industry trade show in Hong Kong. Saul wanted me to attend a couple of meetings with prospective partners who were also going to be at the show. He also wanted to be sure that we set aside time to discuss the possibility of working with him beyond this one project. The company had on display, behind thick plexiglass, a pair of stunning diamonds, one a flawless clear stone, the other a perfect yellow diamond. These were not shards to be lost in the shag carpeting, but showcased gems that were nearly palm-sized. They had the intended effect on the public. Show attendees came by the booth and gawked. And something about the way visitors became slack-jawed made me think that the stones might not be real. When one woman, a tall redhead, stopped and looked dispassionately at the display, I asked her if she thought they were. "They're real, all right," she said, surprised that I would be working at an exhibition, but did not seem to know the difference. She then explained how you could tell. It had to do with how the light refracted from the diamonds. I thanked her for the easy lesson, and I asked her what she was doing at the show. She was from Dallas, Texas, but worked primarily out of Africa. Her business had her joining safaris there, and she sought out a particular kind of high-end adventure, one that put her in the company of big-game hunters who were spectacularly wealthy. On these hunting trips, she wore jewelry she had designed herself. Looking at just the necklace she wore, I could imagine her decked out in a safari outfit with jewels dangling about her neck, ears, and wrists, while holding an elephant gun. Most of the participants on these adventures were married men, who by the end of their trips felt rather guilty about spending $100,000 on a safari and returning home empty-handed. More often than not, she said, someone from the hunting party would ask her to have something made for his wife back home. I have the piece made up while we are still in Africa and have it sent by FedEx. If the timing is just right, the package arrives just as he's walking through the door. She said that she was in the business of saving marriages. It was a fascinating career that she had made for herself, I thought, the opportunity to work abroad while meeting new people. "You heard about what happened at the show?" she asked. That morning, a gang of con artists from South America had walked away with a small case of diamonds stolen from a Belgian diamond merchant. Two of the criminal group had posed as a married couple, while another pair pretended to be wholesalers. With the merchant's attention diverted, a fifth went into the booth and lifted the diamonds. Everyone was talking about the case, and the gang was said to have walked away with over $1 million worth of diamonds. Allowing someone else to take my place in the Plotnik exhibit, I went to where the robbery had taken place with my new friend. Hong Kong police officers were hovering about, while a number of curiosity seekers looked on. The Belgian who had been robbed was slumped in a chair, looking particularly devastated. "Surely the guy has insurance," I said. "Of course he does. He will probably even inflate the value of whatever was taken, but that doesn't make up for it." "How's that?" "People are superstitious, and it's a commodity product. When you can get your diamonds from anyone, why buy them from someone who has such bad luck?" The theft cast a shadow over the exhibition, with exhibitors alternatively trading gossip and trying to pretend that they did not want to know anything about what had just happened. That afternoon, Saul said that he wanted me to meet with one of his prospective partners, a diamond dealer from Hong Kong. My impression of most Hong Kong business merchants was positive, and I had actually liked another that Saul introduced me to, but this prospect did not seem right. Privately, I told Saul that I did not have a good feeling about him. The fellow reminded me of those shady dealers that the South China Morning Post was often reporting on, the ones who gave kickbacks to tour group leaders who brought tourists through their shops. For a moment, he looked thoughtful, as if he might actually be considering my comments, but then he brushed them off as irrelevant. Saul thought that I might be able to help his company, but in some other capacity. He wanted an office set up, and he wanted to start developing business in South China. While he wanted to talk details, his brother had objections. The two of them spoke about me while I was within earshot. "He has no diamond experience," Saul's brother said. The brother lifted a jeweler's loop that hung from a lanyard on his neck to make his point. Saul later told me not to worry about his brother's objections. All of this business about reading a diamond, he said, was not so difficult. He gave me some promotional material from a nearby booth. It was a catalog from the Gemological Institute of America. One of their courses, he said, would help fill in any knowledge gaps. "How long is the course?" I asked. "Maybe a week," he said. "Only a week?" It didn't sound like a very long time at all. I told Saul that his brother might want to consider that it took a great deal more time to learn Chinese, and that I had been working in China for a number of years. Whatever difficulties the company would face, they certainly would have more to do with understanding the marketplace than the product. China was not such an easy nut to crack, I said. As with other clients, I advised caution, as well as a clearer understanding of the challenges ahead. No matter what their strategy for China was going to be, I suggested that they find someone who was strong in handling China affairs. If I was not a suitable person to work with them for the long term, then I would help them to find someone who was. The trip was winding down, and we were in a taxi on the way to the airport in Hong Kong. Saul took the time to offer his take on China and his assessment of my own outlook. "You worry too much," he said. "This one you should watch out for, and that one," parroting my earlier remarks. "You know, if I worried as much as you did about business, I wouldn't have any business." Believing that he was onto something, he continued making his point. "You have to work with what you've got. Not everyone in business is honest. Fine. I have one customer who is always cheating me on the carat weights. He always says the diamonds weigh a little less than they actually do. So what? I get a good price for the diamonds. Someone else I knew had made a similar point about business, that it didn't matter if a person was dishonest, so long as you got what you wanted out of the deal. Hong Kong's neon skyline could just barely be seen in the distance as we drove down the highway. It was late. Saul continued to lecture me in the dark. There's a supermarket I know in Italy, he said. They put little things by the cash register so that the customers have something to steal while they're waiting in line. It's good for business. Some of what Saul said amused me. Now I was laughing. This was one of the reasons I worked with these colorful characters. Never mind the entertainment value, these were lessons that you didn't get in business school. This notion of a company knowingly putting out things to be stolen was a riot, though I didn't like the rest of the implication that I was in some way naive. Saul seemed to be giving me a kind of brush off, but then he surprised me by asking how much I would charge to help him with the company's business in China. His criticisms had been a setup. He was knocking me, like a prospective car buyer pointing out dents in a fender. The airport loomed into view, and he pressed me for a number. Nu, tachlis, he said. He wanted me to get right to the point, but there was none. What I brought to the table was formal business training and a background in China. His brother had already made it clear that things like language skills and on-the-ground experience didn't count. What they wanted was someone who could count occlusions through a jeweler's loop, even if the skill only took a week to pick up. The Plotniks flew back to Europe, and it was the last time we ever spoke. Saul and his brother hired someone else. I heard from a friend that the new hire was an Israeli who had once worked in diamonds. He had been a diamond polisher for some years in Eastern Europe. It was his only real qualification. He had lived in China for a couple of years, but he didn't speak any Chinese, and even his English was said to be lacking. The new hire helped Plotnik by setting up an office in Shenzhen, the city just across the border from Hong Kong, but nothing moved. Demand was weaker than the brothers had figured, and they had not anticipated how strong competition was either. The diamond polisher they hired was apparently unable to develop any business for the company. He was, they said, not up to the job. Foreign companies often brought in expatriates who were not capable of operating inside of China. Unable to speak the language, they could not order lunch for themselves. And, unless they had a business card in their hand, they couldn't get across town in a taxi. If a fire broke out in their office building, they needed to find a translator to explain why everyone was running around. The story did not end well for either the diamond polisher or for the Plotniks. Unable to make things happen, the fellow they hired grew frustrated in his job. After more than a year of failing to make any progress with the business, one day he went into the office that he had set up for the company, cleared out the diamonds that were kept in the safe there, and skipped town. Interpol eventually caught up with the diamond polisher somewhere in Central America, but without the $5 million worth of diamonds that was initially claimed to have been stolen. He was sent to prison and served a lengthy sentence, and the incident made international headlines. It was one of those stories floating around South China, and it also made the rounds in the diamond industry, which specialized in this sort of gossip. For years to come, whenever China and diamonds came up in the same industry conversation, so did this one company's name, not as an example of how things should be done in China, but as a cautionary tale.